Hello and welcome to the Approach Angle podcast, a pitcherless podcast dedicated to teaching you all things baseball analytics. I'm your host, Nate Schwartz, joined as always by Director of Analytics, Kyle Bland. Kyle, what's going on?
Exciting time to be a sports fan. The Knicks just won the NBA championship. FIFA World Cup's going on. I get to renew my four-year cycle of learning a ton about soccer stats and trying to apply them and glean some ideas from that and apply it to baseball. So great time to be a sport fan.
Yeah, one of the few times we've been recording and I haven't had baseball on in the background. So, you know, the second screen is going really strong here. But we're going to get right into it today. So 2 weeks ago, we were joined by Alex Chamberlain and we talked about induced vertical break and vertical approach angle and really got into things such as height adjusted vertical approach angle, which takes a lot of important characteristics about pitches and put it into a single number. But today we're going to be talking about a lot more familiar version of that, and that's going to be stuff models. So, you know, a different and kind of more widely discussed approach in taking a bunch of pitch characteristics and incorporating it into that single number, looking to define the quality of a pitch. So, you know, as we've talked about this vaguely previously, and it's really kind of proliferated, you know, baseball analytics discussion over the last couple of years. It's really become a dominant force in how we talk about pitching at a broad scale. So today we're really going to get into breaking down, you know, what is stuff, the thinking behind kind of what goes into stuff models and then how to use them. But to really start us off on the other side of the equation, the really kind of the non-numerical and viewing side, when a scout says a pitcher has great stuff or an analyst, you know, a TV announcer, you know, what are they actually observing? What goes into that judgment call?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the past, I think different teams would have different measures of it that they would try and say, like, you would try to maybe look for like more ride, run, tail, what have you, for like a fastball. They want to see, like, it's probably defined as like late break for their breaking pitches, or even things like, does he keep his arm speed up for a changeup? That there's a lot of like kind of scouty terminology. I think Fangraphs has a really good article that's like quantifying or like qualifying scouting terminology. And a lot of that goes into kind of the idea of like, that guy's nasty, that guy has good stuff. And like from a scouting standpoint, it's, I mean, the big one is going to be the velo. You hear all the time about, oh, he brought the radar gun to the, you know, to the park. Let's get some readings, because that's big, basically, like, now we know, but, you know, even back for as long as baseball has been around, that velo matters for pitching, that the less time a batter has to deal with whatever the pitch is doing on the way to the plate, that the worse they're going to do. And so that's kind of the biggest one driver of like previous kind of scouting stuff. But there's also things of like understanding how much bite different pitches have, two plane movement you'll hear a lot, and so that's like to the side, like movement to the side and drop or vert, how much cut, how much, you know, how much does he shift the ball, like all of these are different like terminologies that like have, that are backed by what we have access to now with all of the great data we get from StatCast and Baseball Savant, and so now we can kind of put numbers to it. But that's kind of, it's putting numbers to like what people see with their eyes. Like, that pitch moved a lot, and now we can say, oh, it moved this much, or it was this fast, or it had, you know, it had late bite at the end. And that could be something like we talked about with like an approach angle of like, how does it approach the plate? And like, if it really dives in at the end, like maybe that's got bite to it. And that's how we would quantify that now. And so I love that baseball has this long history and like a narrative history. And one of my personal favorite things to do is to try and put a number to that, to try and give a value to, oh, well, that pitch was a mistake. And so how often is a guy throwing mistakes? And that's how we get to our, you know, PLV mistake rate, that kind of thing.
Yeah. On the velocity side, it's really kind of funny to me. You know, it's been so argued, you know, for better or worse over the last, you know, probably 10 years or so about really the increase in velocity, both at the major league game, but then going all the way down to the youth levels. And as you kind of see with any of these stuff models, these pitch quantifiers, stuff like that, that there is nothing more straightforward in benefiting your outcome than increasing velocity. Like, yes, there are certain pitch shapes that work really well, and you can find kind of, you know, nooks and crannies within these things of, oh, you know, a slider with this shape works really well, or this changeup, you know, has great deception and works off well off of other pitches. But if you add 3 miles an hour to your fastball or 4 miles an hour to a slider, like, you know, more often than not, that is almost guaranteed to be super beneficial to your overall profile. And it makes that hard not to chase. That's the easiest thing to make number go up and increase swings and misses and increase your overall results. So, you know, why wouldn't people really want to chase that? But when we really start translating kind of all of these characteristics, you know, things such as your movement profile, you know, the shapes, the release traits, stuff like that, you know, what is that kind of generally accounting for across the board? But then also, what does that miss, if anything?
So basically, like I said, we have kind of these measurements of these traits that we're talking about. I tend to group them into calling them physical traits of the pitch. It's things, how they interact with their physical environment. So it's how fast they move through the air, so get from the pitcher to home plate, where the ball is released. And that's in terms of like how far out in front the pitcher is. So that would be their extension, height, the horizontal location, movement, how fast the movement is happening. So like acceleration. So those are all like physical traits of the pitch. And the ones that we have measurements for, well, what's important is we want to try and like, okay, holistically, how valuable are all of these things at once? Because there's not, you know, a ton of great ways to really dial the knob and be like, oh, well, if you add 1 mile an hour or 2 inches to this pitch, it's going to be this. Like, you have to take them as kind of a holistic entity, or you see them as a holistic entity because that's how you're provided them. And so that's the point of kind of a stuff model, is taking all of these things, all these different variable inputs, and outputting a single, like, this is how valuable, useful, nasty this combination, this particular combination of traits is. And the reason that we do something like a stuff model, and the reason why, you know, they're a little bit more complex and why there's so many different ones, is because there are a lot of decisions and philosophies that go into it, because the way that these things interact can be complex and aren't necessarily linear. So we've talked about movement. We talked about IVB, you know, in a previous episode, and how more doesn't always mean better. So if you're getting more IVB on a sinker, that might actually put the pitch into like a dead zone, like an expected movement profile, versus, well, if you get less vertical break, then actually that's better. Now it's going underneath a hitter's, like, where they expect the ball to go to. And all of this too is, how does it relate to their arm angle, to where they release the ball? Because a hitter has expectations there. And so just considering that single metric, IVB, there are different ways that other physical characteristics of that pitch make more IVB mean it's a worse pitch, a better pitch, a roughly similar pitch. And so we need to know those other factors in order to gauge, well, how valuable, like, this pitch was this valuable and it has this level of movement.
And I know that there's, you know, something to be said for, there are so many factors that go into what makes a pitch good, how a pitch moves, everything that goes into it, that, you know, trying to be kind of big tent baseball analytics here, you know, understanding how high quality a pitch is being put into one number where 100 is league average is really helpful, because, you know, there is so many different things and different, you know, archetypes that change things, where, you know, if you're not paying to the intricacies of a certain pitch type and how everything moves relative to an arm angle, you know, you don't necessarily have to. It can be that kind of big jumping off point.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that's, yeah, explainability, interpretability, kind of usability, that, like, rather than tell you that his fastball is 95, it gets, you know, 16 inches of IVB, it gets 4 inches of horizontal, it's, you know, he releases it from a 6.25 foot release. Like, I can give you all of that information and that means nothing to you, but I can tell you, like, oh, it's stuff plus is 110. And like, if you know stuff plus and understand the scale, you'll know, okay, that's an above average pitch. Like, that's a good pitch. And like, that might not be immediately available or understandable from some of the underlying characteristics. And one of the things is like kind of deceptive pitches. So we talked about vertical approach angle and height adjusted vertical approach angle, and that lower slot guys, you know, their fastballs can tend to play up if they, because of the a flatter approach angle, even if they have less velo. And so it helps to explain that kind of thing of like, how do you know, how does he succeed with a 92 mile an hour fastball? And it's because all the other physical traits of it allow it to be, you know, more deceptive, to move in ways that aren't predicted, that kind of thing. And so I think that's a really important kind of consideration, is to just understand like, this is what his fastball is, rather than giving you a table of numbers. You know, I'll send you a CSV of it. You can take a look. That'll tell you how good it is. It's all in the CSV. It's a million rows. It's 37 columns. Like, there, you got it. You know what it is. Like, no, here's, it's stuff less, 110, bang, easy, done.
And one of the things that you do kind of miss on the other side of that is that, you know, you might be sacrificing accuracy at the extremes, right? Where you are training on just everything, you know, since I believe, generally speaking, like 2021-ish or so, of, you know, all of the pitchers that we've seen. And there's a lot of baseball history. And we see even today that guys will come up throwing pitches that no one's ever seen before. I mean, Jacob Mizorowski is kind of the obvious example here, where you have a starter throwing 104 with a 95 mile an hour slider. And, you know, no one really needs a model to tell you that's good. But at the same time, there isn't kind of the historic data backing up, you know, what is that supposed to do, because we haven't seen it before. Another example might be Tyler Rogers' arm angle, where there's, you know, it's so submarine and everything looks really weird, or even like a Nolan McLean with all of his crazy extreme movement profiles, where there are things that, you know, we haven't really seen, and how they all work together, you know, might cause a model to fall apart, but that doesn't mean it's, you know, not correct in the sense it's not grasping, you know, what we exactly want it to do. So, you know, my question to you here is, you know, do these models generally, since we've had a decent amount of track record with them, and I know you've had, you know, a couple of years of yours being out there, do the models even do what we want them to do?
I'd say yes, that generally capturing the value of a pitch's physical traits, they do a good job of that. And, you know, depending on kind of what you're trying to do with it, they can do a very good job of it. And you can kind of pick and choose what model you like, because we'll get into how you build them, and there are different decisions you can make that have different outcomes. But they do a good job of telling you, like, this combination of traits leads to more runs, fewer runs than league average. And that's really useful. One of the kind of problems with it is these physical traits, because you're combining all of these things and looking at them holistically, there can be not a ton of variability of, like, if you know this is the velo, this is how it moves, this is where it was released from, that you can start to get into like, oh, well, only three pitchers can do that. Like, only, like, or, you know, we talked about Jacob Mizorowski. If you know that the pitch is coming in at 104 miles an hour and it had over 7 feet of extension, well, that's basically just Mizorowski. And so stuff models can, as it was phrased to me by a staffer for an MLB team, identity and quality are not independent. They're highly correlated. So you kind of know, well, that, you know, that combination of traits is Mizorowski's fastball, and that gets good results. So that combination of traits likely gets good results. There are ways to kind of manage that and control for it, how the model is trained, how you, you know, optimize and tune your parameters, that kind of thing. That's a, you know, much more into the weeds technical side of it. But at a high level, kind of this idea, the broad general way that stuff models are trained now leads to it being very tough to basically separate, like, knowing who the pitcher is and predicting what the results are. That you can get a lot of confidence in, well, it's probably estimating that it's this pitcher, and that's why it estimates these results. There's, you know, especially once you get to, like, kind of away from those extremes, so more towards, like, kind of the fat middle of the bell curve, you can get to things of, like, okay, it can differentiate a little better because now there's a lot more variability in that space, you know, because we have a much broader sample to draw from, the things can kind of be tweaked one way or another, and you can have now a sequence of, like, two dozen pitchers that have that kind of trait. And so it's less like, oh, it knows, you know, what Andrew Abbott looks like. And well, yeah, well, he probably looks like a couple other people too. And so it can be tricky to separate, or not tricky, but like it's harder to basically project, oh, it's him, than it would be for these guys kind of at the extremes that we've been talking about.
And that generally makes like intrinsic sense of kind of the, again, on the outliers of how everything matches to itself. But these stuff models are kind of a pitch level concept at its core, right? You're trying to quantify a specific pitch and see how good it is relative to, you know, others in that pitch type. But you'll also see, and you'll also hear it a lot discussed, that, you know, oh, this pitcher has a 104 stuff plus, and, you know, as a whole across their entire arsenal. Does that distinction matter when talking about a pitcher's stuff numbers, or is it really worthwhile in seeing, you know, at the specific pitch level and usage level, what it looks like?
Yeah, I think generally at, you know, across most publicly available stuff models, I've observed it in our stuff model, that secondary pitches and especially breaking balls are generally nastier, so result in like a higher stuff value, or that they prevent runs more often than fastballs, and especially like then so four seamers and sinkers. They, and this is also like observable across baseball, that those secondary pitches yield higher whiff rates and they generally result in weaker contact. And so those are both extremely high value outcomes for a pitch, especially that weaker contact. And so if you're looking solely at swing outputs, which we'll talk about later, then they'll definitely grade higher, because those are the two biggest outcomes for a swing, is did they make contact and how good was that contact. So, you know, so that basically gets to like why secondaries generally run higher stuff values if you're looking at just like runs prevented. The result of this is that you can get something that's like, oh, he's got a good fastball, and that good fastball can have a worse stuff value than someone else's bad slider. So like something like a 105 stuff fastball can be solidly above average for fastballs, but a 110 slider might be just league average, or even maybe below average. And that holistically, from a run prevention standpoint, the slider is still better, even though like when you cut down to the pitch type, it's worse compared to the rest of baseball. And so it's important to keep that in mind, like when you're looking at like what is his stuff plus versus what is his pitch type stuff plus. Usually when you're aggregating anywhere above like the singular pitch or the pitch type level, you're looking at overall runs prevented. And so that'll be basically like, okay, he threw his fastball 60% of the time, his slider 30, his changeup 10, and here's what we think combined their expected run value is, and then that's what you base the stuff plus model or value off of. When you're looking down at that pitch type level, or even like a per pitch level, you can take some different tacts that I'm a fan of, kind of at a pitch type level, presenting it in two different ways, looking at like kind of an overall type agnostic stuff value. And so that would be something like basically just how many runs are they prevented relative to every single pitch thrown across baseball. And that is kind of one way of looking at it. And then another way of looking at it is in the context of the type, or even like the group, like fastball, breaking ball, off speed, or, you know, curveball, slider, changeup, that kind of thing. And then you can see like, okay, this was an above average changeup, this was a below average curveball, this was an average fastball. And you can get an idea then of like, okay, how good are these specific pitches in terms of like what they are, and how good are they at preventing runs? And then that kind of can also give you kind of a semblance of, is this pitcher, you know, doing an optimal mix of pitches, that kind of thing. And there are a lot of considerations too into why pitchers will use like fastballs more often, a worse stuff pitch, you know, because control and command is valuable. And we'll talk about that probably a little bit later. But there are a lot of trade-offs to this. You know, stuff isn't an end-all, be-all model, but it's important to understand kind of some of those distinctions. And when we're talking about especially different pitch types, that there are some differences between how they rate.
And just kind of to wrap up this section, Now, the reason that stuff is so important is that generating kind of run values and on the quality of pitch is so important, is that it is kind of the most predictable, right? Where if you're looking at all of this stuff before the hitter, you know, swings at it, puts it in play, and you leave it up to the batted ball luck that we've talked about before, it's easier to forecast what that's going to look like based on a variety of things. It's really difficult to, when you get into, oh, this guy is great at mitigating contact, hard contact, and looking into that, you know, we've examined how difficult that can be, and it does leave kind of gaps in maybe your standard evaluations. But looking at stuff, as Kyle's kind of said, holistically in terms of, you know, preventing runs in the per pitch type level really gives you kind of that level of insight into future success. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into how stuff models are built. And we're back. So now we're going to get into kind of the basis and background of how the stuff models are built and kind of the decision making that goes into that and generating that, you know, top line number. But Kyle, what typically kind of across the board goes into a stuff model? Is there really kind of a boilerplate set of characteristics, or really does it vary depend on, you know, who's creating the model and what the goal is?
Yeah, so I would say there are core features. And so that would be things like velo, how fast the pitch is, movement, and usually that is described in terms of vert and horizontal movement, and then extension. So like where, how far the pitcher released the pitch relative to the pitching rubber. And so those are like, I would say those are your boilerplate. Those are going to be, or at least probably should be, in every model, every stuff model that you look at, that those are kind of the most innate ones. And they're also probably ones that are also most extensible across baseball leagues. So like not just MLB, but like if you're looking at like TrackMan data, or, you know, if you're going into it like a, you know, a dev facility with a cage, that they're likely to have at least like those values. And so I think that those are kind of the baseline stuff model features. Other ones that are really that have importance and provide a lot of like unique benefits are things like release traits. So I've talked about release height and horizontal location of release, but there's even things like now with arm angle that gives us a even better way to like understand how a pitcher is moving to pitch that ball, and that informs kind of the expected traits that a hitter is going to, you know, expect to see as that pitch is coming. And so if you differ from that, that's going to be kind of nastier. Things like approach angles. We talked about vertical approach angle and height adjusting it in a previous episode, but also horizontal approach angle. So those are basically how the pitch is approaching the plate at the plate. And so that'll be things of kind of like bite, or is it like bearing in on someone, or it's, you know, it's coming downhill, or it's feels like it's rising, that kind of thing. Spin features, you know, the most obvious would be like spin rate. How much is it spinning? Spin direction. So like, what is the direction of the spin? But even, you know, one of the modern sabermetric features that's gotten, I know, a lot of talk going back over a decade now is seam shifted wake. And so that's, we talked a little bit about that with movement, of how the seams are oriented affects movement beyond just how the spin is happening, and things like active spin rate. So are they spinning it? You know, is that spin that they're applying to the ball, how much is that informing the movement that we see? You can get things like, you know, gyro sliders where there's not a lot of active spin at all, or even things like a knuckler or, you know, a splitter fork ball kind of thing where there's not a lot of spin. And so maybe spin, active spin rate isn't as important. So spin features. And then another one that's usually interesting is differentials from the rest of the pitch mix. And so this would be things of like, I tend to like velo and movement differences from the pitcher's primary fastball. So basically, like, because you hear a lot about velo bands or velo separation. So if a guy's throwing 95 and then he's got, you know, an 88 mile an hour slider, and then he's got an 80 mile an hour curveball, okay, those are three different velo bands. And that gives you an idea of, okay, well, what is a hitter, if they have to sit the fastest pitch, like how does the time differential between them, like that, the bigger that is, the bigger that gap, you know, the harder it is, the likelier they are to kind of miss that. And so that would be differential. And then, so those are other physical characteristics that could be included. On top of that, there are also some contextual ones of how do you factor in count? Because we know that hitters change their behavior as counts change, that what they do in a 3-0 count is a lot different than a 0-2 count is different than the first pitch of a plate appearance. And so that may make things like whiffs or weak contact more or less likely. And so there are a myriad of ways to handle count. How do you handle handedness? Do you get like lefties just get a bump because they're just better people? Just kidding. But like they're like,
yes, less...
agreed.
Yes.
But they're, you know, they're less common. They're the hitters don't see them as much. So there's a value just to being left-handed. Or is it things like platoon? Like, okay, this guy's a same hand. This guy's an opposite hand. And so stuff will behave differently according to it. Or do you get really granular and just be like, all right, righty pitcher, lefty hitter is different than lefty pitcher, righty hitter, even though they're, you know, the same kind of platoon matchup. And so those are like kind of contextual features that can go into it. And the different, you know, everyone's got a different sauce. Everyone's got a different proprietary spice blend for all of these things. And you'll see a ton of great models out there. We have ours on our player cards and we'll get them on the site soon. But then you have, you know, of course, Stuff Plus, probably the most like publicly known available on Fangraphs, along with Pitching Bot's Stuff model. Stuff Pro over at Baseball Prospectus is awesome. And then I've seen a lot of like really great work with kind of individual Stuff models that TJ Stats has TJ Stuff Plus, Pitch Profiler has Pro Stuff Plus, in addition to like, There are so many other cool people that do a lot of other interesting things. And for someone like me, knowing how they're different means that I can see what those differences mean. But it is kind of like, well, if you like one, stick to it. They all generally do kind of a similar thing. But there are, you know, a lot of fun ones. And generally, a lot of these people also tell you how they get there and also solicit feedback really well. So lots of stuff models, lots of possibilities for things that go into them. But you know, at the end of the day, how good are those physical characteristics is the goal.
And I think of kind of the variety of stuff models out there, similar to how you might see all of the projections that show up on a player's Fangraphs page, where generally kind of across the board, you're seeing very similar numbers. Like all of the ranges are kind of within reason to one another. And it's more kind of learning, you know, here or there, are there different systems that do slightly different things that give you a preferential treatment? Or like, I know that like on the Fangraphs player pages, I have kind of gravitated towards like the Bat X for hitter projections. And it kind of is like, oh, well, I know that they really use StatCast data a lot. And I trust that. So I'm going to use that. It's a lot of kind of, you know, choose your flavor along kind of all of the same levels and same, you know, variety of data. But mm-hmm. kind of getting into how the models, you know, attempt to capture some of this stuff, you know, how are they, you know, looking kind of at a grand scale at movement? Is it always just like more movement good, more separation good, you know, in the case like of a same-handed hitter, are you trying to make sure that everything is moving, you know, horizontally and against an opposite handed hitter, you're looking to move vertically, or is it, you know, a little more nuanced than that?
I mean, it depends on what model you're looking at. I'm not going to, you know, speak for everyone and say they all do this or even that this is the right way. But we've talked about in our IVB episode things about how velo influences how maybe impressive that movement is, that getting the same movement from a faster pitch is kind of harder or like more difficult than average to do. And so some models do control for that by using like acceleration as a proxy for movement, that, well, that pitch accelerates in this direction. And then you kind of control out that, well, how does, you know, how much time does the pitch have in flight to do that movement kind of thing? All right. I just had a thought like while you're doing that, but even so, I just put a tweet out because, you know, we've got this new miss distance stuff. And so I was looking at actually how movement relates to swing paths. And I know we've heard a couple years ago in the playoffs, Dave Roberts subbed in a hitter based on, well, his path matches up better against, I think Josh Hader was the pitcher. And so different you know, steeper paths mean a given movement profile will appear different to different hitters. And so, like, more rise up and down is going to seem more up and down to a flat path, but for a more vertical, steeper path, it's going to be moving along the bat rather than perpendicular to it. And so that's something I think that there may be some room for controlling for kind of like, well, what are the paths that they've faced? How does this stuff move relative to the bat path? That's going to be, you know, off-season research. I don't, you know, it may not actually help anything. It may be more like interesting or like explanatory at the batter side, but not as useful on the pitcher side. But these are all just kind of different ways to capture something that seems as simple as how did the pitch move.
And that kind of gets into, generally speaking, how all of this plays together of, are you finding the right matchups? Are you, you know, creating everything on the pitching side that goes together, right? Where if you know in the scouting reports that, you know, maybe a bat path doesn't line up well with your, you know, poorly graded sinker, are you going to throw that way more to a specific batter because you know it's going to work? And kind of vice versa, you know, what level is your fastball, is your slider so good that you can just kind of overthrow it and say, it's good enough. It doesn't really matter who's hitting, you know, I can get a guy out this way. But, you know, most models and most of the really the thoughts behind some of these stuff models is kind of seem to be kind of geared towards whiffs. And I know a lot of that is because, you know, run values on a swing and miss is, you know, higher than anything put in play. Is that kind of, in your view, the right optimization path for some of these models, or does it leave something to be desired?
I think there's a lot of different ways to go about this. So I think there are kind of like two forks that you kind of have if you're like making a stuff model. And the first being, well, you can choose to use like an expected run value based model, which is basically just looking at this pitch, the end result of this pitch was this run value. And so that, you know, the change in that run value is what the pitch did. And then you use that as your target value for the model. Or what we do, what my personal style is outcome based, where we use these to predict individual outcomes for the pitches. And by that, I mean like, okay, I think this pitch is going to be a single this amount of the time, a whiff this percent of the time, a called strike, you know, a weakly hit ground ball, that kind of thing. And then you can assign run values after the fact. Once you have all of your outcomes, you can give them all different values, and then you combine their probabilities and values, and you get that end number, that single value. So that's kind of how do you go about predicting, like figuring out what your target is for the model. And then within it, now you're looking at, well, what are you training the model on? And I've seen kind of two different paths for that. And it goes into, well, what pitches are you including? And some utilize only swings, that if we're trying to tease out location, the biggest location is the biggest influence on things like swinging and taking. That if a pitch is any more than, you know, 6 inches outside of the zone, that's going to be a take a lot of the time. It doesn't matter. The great, I don't care how fast you throw a ball for. That's kind of that idea, that the stuff does, you know, that's not kind of representative of what a pitch can do, that it's not worth kind of predicting like the run value of it. That was bad, but it's also because of the location. We know that's bad. Like the location is massive there. And so you just look at swings. And so that'll be like, then you'd be focusing on whiff versus contact, and then contact in play, and then how good the batted ball results is. And so, like I said, so whiffs and batted ball results. And so a stuff model there can mean like, oh, he gets a lot of whiffs, or it can also mean he manages contact well. And then the other side is using all pitch outcomes. And this is, I think, tracks more with the expected run value based, because you don't have to worry about making a model to predict called strikes or balls or hit by pitches using no location, because that's really tough. But you get kind of a better understanding of, you're not throwing away data. There are some things where maybe certain pitches have a ability to be commanded better, or maybe certain pitches get called strikes at a higher rate, like certain physical shapes. I've seen talk that
bigger shapes lead to fewer swings, and that's either because batters don't expect it to land in the zone if it seems like it's going out of the zone, or if they see this big looping breaker come in, they're like, oh, that's going to run away from me. I don't want to deal with that, that kind of thing. So there's things like that where the shape of the pitch influences, are they more or less likely to swing, or they could be easier to control. Like you think of like a splitter or a forkball, and that those can be a little bit trickier to control because there's not as much kind of spin to make kind of like a rifling effect that helps keep it consistent. It can kind of be a little more variable. You see it a lot on movement plots, that the spread of how the pitches move is a lot wider versus something like a sinker, which generally has a very compact, you know, consistent release traits that it's going to be expected, where you expect it to be a lot, and that's probably easier to control, and so it'll probably result in fewer balls and walks. So those are kind of a few different philosophies in how you get to what your stuff model is like, what the outcome you want is, whether it's pure run values or whether you want to predict outcomes, or and then what you're using to predict that target, whether that's only swing data because you understand, or the idea being that, well, location drives takes and take value way more than kind of location drives swing value relatively, or you look at all pitches because you want to understand that, like, well, there's probably still some signal to pitches getting more called strikes than average, or fewer, allowing fewer balls than average, that kind of thing.
One of the things that's really stuck with me for the last few years now is, I think I've said it on this podcast before, I've definitely said it in a lot of places, but that location gets whiffs and stuff gets hit suppression. And while that seems very counterintuitive, when you think about it for a second, it kind of makes sense that, you know, you throw a perfectly executed slider down and away, more often than not, that is going to get a swing and miss because of everything else that goes into where that pitch is and physically what, you know, a hitter is capable of. And stuff is really the, oh, if you throw a pitch down the middle, the pitch with the better qualities is going to be harder to square up and do damage with, which, you know, it's kind of backwards, and having really good stuff increases the ranges at which you're able to get swings and misses and get good outcomes. But it really kind of holistically changes how you view stuff in coordination with how a pitcher is performing and how they are, you know, in a specific game at a specific pitch level, rather than just in the aggregate and just kind of dumbing them down, not dumbing them down, but, you know, simplifying them or a pitch into one number, because it does, you know, this is the It Depends podcast, and, you know, it depends more often than not of what pitch was thrown before them, you know, in stuff where the location is, stuff like that. But, you know, we'll get into kind of PLV here specifically, as I know you've told me in the show notes here that it is outcome-based, which we'll get into. But does that lead to, in your mind, certain biases and, you know, potentially miss out on certain pitch types or pitch shapes?
I think the biggest downside of an outcome-based model is you're stacking model errors, because what you're generally doing, or at least how we do it for PLV and how I've seen other people do outcome-based modeling, is you have kind of a suite that you're using, like, okay, here's our model to predict, are they going to swing or not? Okay, now that we know that they're swinging or have a estimate for swing, okay, here's our model to predict, will they make contact on that swing? And then, okay, now that we know they're making contact, will that go in play? And then, okay, we know it's going in play. Okay, will it be a batted ball? And so now we're talking about, once you get to like a batted ball prediction, we've stacked four different models together. And that's four different sources of bias, four different sources of error. And so if you know, aren't doing your due diligence, you know, that can grow out of hand very quickly. That even if one model along the way is poorly calibrated or tuned in correctly or whatever, then that can throw every subsequent outcome down the chain completely out of whack. And so that's, I think, the biggest downside to using an outcome-based model. I think the upside, or, you know, the flip side being the direct run value predictions, what their downside is it's a little less interpretable, that you get the number, you get their stuff value, you get the run value. But why? How do we get to that value? You don't get as much. Is it because they're generating more whiffs? Is it because they're getting better batted ball results? Is it average because both of those are average? Or is it because whiffs are great, but they're also getting hit hard? That I personally like understanding kind of the how of we get to that number and like breaking it down into segments or components. And then you also lose a bit of, we've talked about like different pitches for different situations, that it's good to have, you know, your out pitch, your put away pitch, that, you know, two strikes, I'm going to this is my bread and butter. I get whiffs with this, but it's, there's value also to knowing like, okay, here's my ground ball pitch. And here's, you know, this guy has a ground ball pitch, so maybe I expect him to be able to pitch more efficiently. He gets those double plays that end an inning more often than someone else. And that's kind of what it also too, that you can look at things like stuff and be like, okay, these two guys have similar stuff values, but this is a ground ball pitcher and this is a whiff pitcher. And you can also get like clean efficiency from that, that someone like Christopher Sanchez is going to be, I would say, more efficient with his pitches because he gets those ground balls. He gets that damage suppression that lead to outs, because you can get an out on the first pitch if it's a batted ball. If you're getting whiffs, it still takes at least three whiffs to get an out. Well, three strikes, but if you're getting all whiffs, it takes three of them to get an out. So being more efficient, pitching deeper into games, there may be some value to, well, if I know that his stuff has good damage suppression, that might lead to him pitching deeper into games. And so I think that there are a lot of like jumping off points that outcome-based gives you kind of a sandbox to play with. You know, everyone wants to know this is the stuff value, and that is very important, very actionable information. But one of the benefits I find is dealing with like the smaller components of it and being like, well, from a fantasy perspective, understanding that like everyone wants the sexy strikeout rates, but if a guy is just as good at mowing down hitters and getting his outs because of ground balls, and that's going to be visible in stuff, that's a guy I'll target because he's likely to be undervalued. And I'm sure teams are doing that too, in terms of strikeouts drive arb salaries and drive free agent salaries. And so being able to understand that like this guy will get us outs, he will run a low ERA, that is what matters to a team and to fantasy players. And so being able to get kind of like an undervalued pitcher that way is extremely important.
And one of the other things in finding an undervalued pitchers in the stuff model era is that training data gets built every single year, every single day, based on new trends. You know, we saw the sweeper pop up very quickly, you know, almost in accordance with kind of stuff models, you know, making their way across, you know, baseball discourse and major league front offices. But then also you've seen recently a lot of cut fastballs start to jump up in the last year or so, even though, you know, they didn't grade out, you know, particularly well by stuff models kind of early on in that iteration. So, you know, will this constantly create kind of a moving target of desirable shapes, underrated pitches and stuff like that, that it's, you know, I think a lot of people were scared that there would be this immediate, oh, everyone is going to be fastball slider with, you know, this incredibly verty fastball and this just kind of death ball slider, and that'll be that. Or is it going to, you know, constantly evolve in, you know, in the next 5, 10, 20 years of pitching?
Yeah, I love it's the cat and mouse game of pitchers and hitters, and everyone adapt. It's adapt or die. And so generally a lot of MLB caliber players will adapt, but you see things like, yeah, you got that super verty four-seam fastball that guys were chasing, IVB, IVB, IVB. But then hitters started seeing more of that. And so that started having less of an impact, or it started being less valuable. And so now we're kind of starting to see like the pendulum swing back of, now it's, well, you also have to have a functional sinker because that's a good damage suppression pitch, or it's even a good change of pace from a fastball. And so being able to have a good one matters a lot. You saw it with kind of the rise and now kind of slow gradual fall of sweepers, that it was, you know, the pitch type that swept the nation. But now that we're, you know, 3-4 years into like it being, I mean, both a queryable pitch type on StatCast, which is cool, but also just being more prominent across baseball, that hitters are used to seeing those huge horizontal movement shapes. And so they're better at seeing them out of hand, better at knowing like, okay, here's how I manipulate my swing to get barrel of the bat to the ball. And so that means that things like maybe the gyro slider, like, you know, that dropped a little bit in lieu of the sweeper, and now maybe that gyro slider is coming back, or maybe it's an increase in big looping curveballs that throw like a velo difference. That there's, you know, all of these trends. It almost feels like seasonality to different pitch types and like what makes them successful. And so it is important to, for all of these stuff models, I guarantee you they're all being retrained every year. That, okay, now we have an entire year's worth of data, and that's just good practice. We have more data, let's use it. But also having more like topical, current, relevant data informs like, here's what the state of baseball is like right now. And so different models will use like, oh, we're training on the last 3 years. I think like Stuff Plus does that. Something like Stuff Pro, they use the year of the pitch as a feature. And so you can kind of then like actually model like, oh, this shape was effective more in 2022 than it is now in 2026, that kind of thing. Different ways to handle it. But everyone's always adding new data whenever they can get to it.
And the other thing is that there will never be kind of one, you know, one size fits all for a pitch that is, will always be good forever. Yes, there are kind of outliers to that, you know. If Jacob Mazurowski throws 104 miles an hour for the next 10 years, like obviously that's going to work. But the goal of pitching is to be misunderstood, right? I said that I think 2 weeks ago, and you know, it's easy to be, oh, well, if everyone's going to be throwing a 10 inch of sweep, 2 inches of drop sweeper, hitters are going to go into the batting cage, hop on the traject machine, which can mimic different pitchers, you know, actual shapes, they're going to get used to it. They're going to be familiar with it, and all of a sudden they're teeing off of it. So it's really, you know, pitchers are going to have to adapt and adjust anyway. And this kind of helps you see how that adapts, you know, year over year and stuff like that. But we're going to take kind of one more break here and get into how you, the fan, the viewer of baseball, can use stuff models. And we're back. So now we're going to get into how to really use stuff models and, you know, put stock in the numbers and actually get value out of that. So kind of first things first here, how quickly can you put stock into stuff numbers, both for rookies who we haven't seen before in stuff models and then also established guys?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for starters, and I mean that for starting pitchers, that you can basically use, like, a game will give you a lot of actionable information. So especially early in the season, if you see a veteran pitcher, you know, you hear a lot about he added a pitch or he's tweaked this or he went to drive line. That, well, let's see kind of how does that play out in a game setting. And you can get actionable information from that very first start. That you need 20-ish pitches to have a sustainable representative sample of what their stuff values are. And, you know, that's true across pitch types as well. For rookies, I think we've seen, you know, Nick's talked about it a lot, that you may not want to fully buy into that first start stuff value because they tend to be really geeked up on adrenaline because it's their debut. You know, they made it. And so they tend to kind of overthrow it. So it might not necessarily be representative of what pitches they actually are going to sustainably throw. But yeah, a single game can mean a lot. I think once you get into a season, there's going to be game-to-game variance, so I wouldn't read too much into kind of small changes and stuff. But if you start to see like, oh, this guy's dropped, you know, a mile or two an hour, that, you know, the stuff values are going to drop accordingly, and that can be kind of a big red flag to be like, okay, well, he's not showing up as injured, you know, he's not immediately going to the IL, but like, maybe there's something wrong here, maybe his mechanics are out of whack, or maybe he's nursing an injury that like he can still pitch through, but he's going to be much less effective. And you can get that information kind of very quickly as well. For relievers, you probably want to still look at like a handful of appearances, 3 or 4. But it can still tell you a lot about a guy. Even, you know, Daniel Espino just made his season debut for the Guardians after years of being hurt and, you know, going through the minors, and his stuff looked great. And it was only an inning, but like you can read a lot from what's his fastball like, even in one inning of pitches.
Yeah, it gets you into the ballpark of where you need to be, especially on the reliever side. But on the starter side, if a starter's sitting 96 in that first start, and it shakes out to 94, how the movement plays and everything else, you know, that goes into stuff means a lot more in how the adjustment looks. But kind of the other side of that with veterans is it can be good to see when there's fall off. But again, this isn't a end all be all here, where I think Brandon Woodruff is a great example of this, where he got injured. You know, it was a really bad injury. It took a long time for him to come back, and there were a lot of worries about him. And he comes back. He was sitting at around, you know, 112 to 108 stuff plus pre-injury. So, you know, above average marks, you know, across the board looked really good. And then he's sitting at around just under league average, 97 in 2024 and 2025. And he, by all accounts, has been a very productive pitcher. Last year, he had a 32% strikeout rate and 3.2 ERA with that worse stuff. And it's one of those things for veterans. It's like these guys have learned how to pitch at the big league level. And, you know, even if the stuff has fallen off a little bit, they, you know, can know how to adapt. Obviously, you play the numbers game and, you know, it's easier to fade a guy who has seen a decrease in stuff. But generally speaking, this isn't like, oh, it's the end of this guy's career. It's starting to fall off. It's like, no, this guy also is capable and probably recognizes that, you know, the stuff is falling off. How can I mitigate that? Am I throwing my slider more, which is a better pitch and gets, you know, I can find a way to get that in the zone more, or vice versa of I'm trying to just overcompensate with the fastball because that's all I know and I can make it work. But is it easy for you to see kind of pitch improvements game over game in that kind of that zone of, oh, a guy might have, you know, changed in season? Can you see that more in the model numbers easily, or is it kind of sometimes more effective on looking at underlying characteristics, maybe start to see where the changes have arisen?
I tend to like looking at the underlying characteristics. Some of this is kind of like me just being in the matrix and understanding what all the numbers trickling down across my spreadsheet say. But I like to see like, okay, a guy's taken, you know, maybe a little bit of vert off of a pitch for more movement. For he's getting, you know, a little bit more bite on that pitch. And so, okay, to me, that might be something of like he's trading whiff ability for contact management. And so I find that personally interesting, even if maybe the stuff stays the same or there's a slight decrease in stuff, that there might be a cognitive change for why he's doing that, other than like, oh, okay, you know, he's worse now. Like, no, there might be like a reason he's doing it. And you can glean that a little bit better from underlying traits than you can from the stuff value. But it's still, you know, it's still important to understand what the stuff is. That usually they'll key you into underlying changes. So if you're not kind of as in it as I am, seeing a stuff number trend up or down will tell you like, okay, something's changing. Oh, he added a tick of velo. Oh, he added 2 inches of break. Oh, he changed his release slot a little bit. That you can kind of use stuff as a bellwether for has something else changed just as well.
Yeah, it can be a good catch-all of, oh, there is something changing. But sometimes, you know, if you're in the deep end and you're looking at like the Baseball Savant player breakdowns and you see that either velocity's up or the kind of the changes for your pitch movement look vastly different, that can be a really good tell that something has changed. I think kind of a big one for me, and just kind of a brief example that is still in my head, was a couple of weeks ago, Michael McGreevy, you know, whipped out multiple, like I think 8+ strikeout games. And you go into the logs and his changeup and his sinker were getting like 2 to 3 inches more of both run and drop. So they were moving more away from left-handed hitters and teams were loading up left-handed bats against him. And, you know, these pitches were just outside of what everyone was expecting, and that was leading to more whiffs and just kind of a really exciting, this might stick. This is a change. It didn't end up sticking, but it was driving kind of the results and surface level changes that you were seeing in the box scores and watching the game. But kind of across the board, do you notice the breakout kind of via stuff, via these characteristics before the ERA or strikeout rate show up, or is that kind of similarly intertwined at the same time?
Oh, I absolutely notice breakouts with stuff way sooner than ERA and even a little bit sooner than strikeout rate. We've talked before with the ERA estimator episode that it's extremely noisy. There are so many things outside of the pitcher's control that show up in ERA. And so, you know, some of those will be consistent. You know, what their home park is going to be the same. Who the defense is behind them is generally going to be similar. But things like who the opposing lineup is, if they're on the road, what that park looks like, those are going to be very sources of variance and that are out of the pitcher's control. And so, you know, I can't get actionable information about the pitcher from that versus stuff does not care for any of that. It doesn't even really matter what the hitter does. That it's just looking at what that pitch is. And so you get a lot more information a lot sooner and without all of the noise of something like ERA. And even like strikeout rate is definitely better than ERA, but there's still a lot that goes into it of like sequencing that you need to be getting to 3 strikes in a plate appearance. So you need to get 1, 2, 3 of them. So different sequencing can affect how you get there. It's also affected by opposing lineup. If you have like a high contact lineup versus more of a 3 true outcomes lineup, that will change the strikeout rates. Even stadium that we've seen, like T-Mobile, that's run higher than expected strikeout rates for years. And so it doesn't seem very intuitive that a stadium can affect strikeout rates, but they do, and they have kind of consistent effects on it. So even strikeout rates, which are pretty stable and are, you know, kind of one of the core pillars of modern kind of sabermetric pitching analysis, it's still, you know, it has its variabilities that stuff does a better job of kind of controlling for and working its way through.
And that across the board is kind of understandable of the aggregated stats are going to take longer to appear, whereas the different changes and the underlying might show quicker. But my last question here today is, you know, if you're purely going off of a Stuff Plus model for your analysis, your evaluation, if you're using it for fantasy or anything, you know, what does that miss? What are you leaving to be desired that either is in another stat that we might cover in sometime in the near future, or generally does, you know, functionally miss across the board?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll hammer this. We've hammered it before that like location is a much larger driver of value than stuff. Like a well-located poor stuff pitch will always do better. Not always, but will consistently do better than a high stuff but poorly located one. We talked about before of like, if you're putting 104 miles an hour 6 inches out of the zone, that's a terrible pitch. If you got 20 inches of break on your sweeper and it's, you know, not competitive, that's a terrible pitch. Versus if you're dotting the corners with an 89 mile an hour sinker, that's still an effective pitch. I think the importance of stuff is it's very powerful in a short amount of time, and it tells you a lot about who the player is, but that doesn't mean that stats that take longer to stabilize aren't important. That if a guy can show he can consistently locate and command, that's very valuable. And so like, I'm open to doing that I'm not going to just say like, oh, he's got bad stuff, he's a bad pitcher. That's not true at all. And I don't think there's not a pitcher who's like, his stuff is so good that it doesn't matter that he's got sloppy control. Like, no, you still need to be able to throw strikes. And if you're suspect with that, you're going to end up a reliever really quickly. And if you have suspect reliever control, you're going to end up out of the league because you just can't afford to be consistently putting guys on base, regardless of what your role is. It doesn't matter how many guys you strike out. You need to keep guys off the base paths because you can string together outcomes and that leads to runs. And that's a lot that, you know, that's the most damaging thing.
Kind of the thing that stuck with me in that regard, I forgot kind of who said it, but everyone's a big leaguer for a reason. They have something that has gotten them to the big leagues through, you know, probably 6 to 7 levels of professional baseball or collegiate or international baseball. You know, maybe with all of the things that are changing in baseball, maybe that number of levels you have to get through becomes less, which is a conversation for another day. But all of these things have done certain things, have certain skills to get them to the highest level of baseball. And even if that isn't showing up here, that does mean that they will find ways and have found ways to be successful baseball players. But that's really going to do it for this episode on Stuff. Kyle, where can listeners find you?
Yeah, so I'm at Blendalytics on all of our social accounts. I'm, you know, putting our work out at PitcherList, doing a lot of research right now. I talked before about like bat path adjusting movement, and we put some fun viz out about that. Doing some other stuff behind the scenes as far as interactions with hitters and pitchers, working with some of our hitter process data to give you a better idea of what their innate talent is. Kind of maybe you could think of it as a loose kind of Stuff model for hitters, I mean, that kind of thing. So just a bunch of different things all going at the same time, but that's what makes the job fun.
And you can find him at Blendalytics on all socials. You can find me. Did take 2 weeks off of writing, but we're back in the upcoming week. Real life unfortunately gets in the way of all of the fun baseball stuff I get to do. But you can find me at _NateSchwartz. And that'll do it for this episode of The Approach Angle. We will see you on the next one.